content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And first today, a hopefully completely unrelatable story about marriage. The couple that survived 4 months floating on the ocean together. This was written by Olga Kazan. In the late 1960s, Maurice and Marilyn Bailey sold their house in Derby in central England and commissioned a 30-foot-long sailboat, the Arlen. Seeking an escape from their boring lives and their dreary English weather, they planned to sail around the world. To preserve their freedom from outside interference, as Maurice put it, they did not bring a radio transmitter aboard. 9 months after departing from the south of England in 1972, they made it through the Panama Canal and into the Pacific when a whale struck their boat, sinking it. A new book, A Marriage at Sea, tells the tale of what happened next. The Baileys transferred themselves, 33 tins of food, and some cookies and coffee mate, into an inflatable life raft and dinghy, each barely the size of a stretched-out adult. They hoped for a ship to sail by and spot them. For nearly 4 months they floated around, filling their time by catching rainwater and turtles, first as pets, then as food. Together they clung to life as starvation and illness set in. Somehow they survived, and they stayed married. And they went on another months-long sailing trip together. The Baileys' experience was, as the book's author Sophie Elmhurst put it to me, hopefully completely unrelatable for most people. It is not, of course, a marriage advice book, but perhaps its story can offer lessons about marriage. The Baileys' seafaring appeared to be a type of shared meaning that relationship experts say can glue couples together. Their mission almost killed them, corporally, but it also seems to have helped their marriage survive. And although most couples would not want to recreate the Baileys' experience, they can experiment with shared meaning-making in other, perhaps drier, ways. The two Baileys were strikingly different. Maurice, who had a troubled childhood marked by illness and emotional neglect, was negative and socially ill at ease. Marilyn, meanwhile, was as socially able as he wasn't, Elmhurst told me, as well as confident and enterprising. They met at a car rally where Marilyn was driving a Vauxhall Cresta with a particular level of chutzpah, as Elmhurst writes. Marilyn suggested living aboard the sailboat even though she didn't know how to swim. She had just had that gung-ho quality, Elmhurst said. As I read the book, I could not understand what Maurice offered Marilyn. Why had she married someone so difficult, with so many cockamamie schemes? I asked Elmhurst for her theory, and she speculated that in an era of deep social conformity, Marilyn found liberation in Maurice's atheism, his desire not to have children, and, well, the whole boat thing. They both loved adventure, and both had a sort of British chin-up mentality that can be useful when soldiering on through something horrible. What Marilyn offered Maurice, though, was clear. Adrift at sea, Maurice started to give up hope quickly, and Marilyn seemed to view spurring him on as a kind of second project, along with engineering their survival. She made dominoes from strips of paper. When 4 gallons of drinkable water drifted away, she tried to raise his spirits by opening their last tin of rice pudding in honor of her birthday. She would assure him that they were meant to survive. They did argue, Elmhurst Elmhurst, excuse me, writes, but after a fight ended, they would unpick it, see why they had snapped, or become intolerant, and apologize. Later, Maryland would claim to reporters that they hadn't argued at all. On the raft, the Baileys discussed the next boat trip they would take as soon as they were rescued. During long days without food or water, they'd fantasize about the provisions for a new boat, the design of the new boat, and where they'd sail it. Patagonia, they figured. This second boat trip was, in some ways, crucial to getting them through that first ill-fated one. Maryland's strategy for keeping Maurice going was to fixate on a future, one that contained a second successful sailing mission. The Baileys' near-death experience became their shared meaning, a way of defining, this is who we are, this is what we do. Says Carrie Cole, the research director of the Gottman Institute, which focuses on couples counseling. It solidified their relationship and in all likelihood made it last. A lot of times when people go through some ordeal like that and they survive it together, it really can connect to them, Cole told me. Nobody else has experienced what they have. It's like they have this deep sense of feeling known and understood. She notes, though, that most people cultivate this shared meaning in less dangerous ways, such as through volunteering or hiking. Another possible takeaway from this unusual duo, Elmhurst speculated, is that perhaps the Baileys showed that, on some level, we all need someone to love. Maurice needed Marilyn to prop him up, and Marilyn needed someone to prop up. In the interviews the pairs gave in the years after their rescue, he'd make this point again and again that, if it hadn't been for her, he'd never have lived. Elmhurst said, perhaps he wouldn't have survived without her even on dry land. Maryland, Elmhurst said, translated him for the world. Maybe, she added, there is something in us that is designed or works well in tandem with someone else. In the book, Elmhurst asked, for what else is a marriage, really, if not being stuck on a small raft with someone and trying to survive? Throughout all the dramas of daily life, the fender bender, the sleep regression, the surprise layoff, partners can start to feel trapped with each other. Maybe that's not the worst thing. Our second story, The Virtue of Integrity, written by Peter Wehner. Jean Gehenno lived in Nazi-occupied France, where, unlike so many of his contemporaries, he refused to write a word for a publishing industry under Nazi control. He felt shame about the Vichy government's collaboration with Nazi Germany. What to make of French writers who, to stay on the right side of the occupation authorities, decide to write about anything but the one thing all French people are thinking about? Gehenno asked in his journal, later published as Diary of the Dark Years. Or worse still, who, out of cowardice, bolster the occupants' plan to make it appear as though everything in France continues as it did before? In an essay for Liberties, Ian Baruma writes that Gehenna's journal is wise, witty, and scathing about his fellow writers, who had elected to proceed as if nothing had changed. Incapable of being in hiding for long, Gehenno wrote, this type of literary figure would sell his soul just to keep his name in print. The United States today isn't occupied France, and nothing currently in America is comparable to the worst of Nazism. But any number of regimes, though they fall short of the German Reich, act in ways that are morally problematic or even wicked. Collaboration and capitulation, the selling of a soul, takes many forms, including in America. integrity is a virtue on which good character is built. Other virtues can be admirable, but isolated. One can be courageous in the pursuit of injustice. A person can be honest, but ungenerous, forgiving, but lazy. Al Capone, after all, sponsored a soup kitchen during the Great Depression. Integrity, whose root word integer means wholeness, is a thing complete in itself, assimilates other virtues. A person of integrity possesses an inner harmony, a moral coherence. As the philosopher Robert C. Solomon put it, integrity is not itself a virtue so much as it is a synthesis of the virtues, working together to form a coherent whole. Integrity is the subject of ancient interest. Plato believed that a tripartite soul included reason, desire, and spirit. For Aristotle, virtue was divided into moral and intellectual categories. Virtue was not a matter of isolated acts. It was an ingrained disposition, an orientation of the mind and heart, developed through practice and habituation. This led to a united life, which in turn led to the highest human good, eudaimonia, or human flourishing, a life of purpose devoted to the good. To be sure, people of integrity aren't perfect, but they are individuals who possess an internal cohesiveness among distinct parts. Their values and behavior display a consistency that is the foundation of trust and mutual respect. No man is a hero to his valet, says the 18th century proverb. Many of those who serve another see a different, darker side to those whom they serve. The closer you get to other people, the more obvious their flaws become. Their public and private lives are at odds with each other. In contrast, a life of integrity works in concert with itself, has a consistency regardless of the circumstances an individual finds themselves in. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance and there is only the dance, T.S. Eliot wrote. People of integrity are still points in a turning world. I've been thinking about integrity a lot lately, in part because more and more it's seen, certainly in politics, as unfashionable. It wasn't always this way. The central figure in the American founding, George Washington, was universally respected for his rectitude. Even the British recognized the quality of his character. When King George III heard that Washington might surrender his commission as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, he reportedly said that if Washington did so, he would be the greatest man in the world. Washington was a complex and elusive figure, as his biographer Ron Chernow wrote, full of pent-up passion. But Washington was also a man of sterling character, brave, devoted to his country, civic-minded, and possessed of an unsurpassed sense of duty. Although he was given great power, he never abused it. As Major General Henry Lee eulogized Washington at his funeral, the purity of his private character gave effulgence to his public virtues. No other president, with the possible exception of Lincoln, was Washington's equal. But for nearly the entirety of American history, up until a decade ago, Washington set the standard. Presidents had to at least appear to be better than they were, offering the tribute that vice pays to virtue. No more. Donald Trump's corruption is borderless in ways we've never seen before. But what's also precedent-shattering is that he doesn't try to hide it. His depravity is all in the open. That his supporters celebrate his bad behavior makes this even more discouraging. Many of them find his behavior thrilling including large swaths of Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals, men and women who worship Jesus with their lips while giving priority to Trump and the MAGA movement in their hearts. Add to the mix the craven, across-the-board capitulation to Trump by one elite institution after another, law firms and tech giants, universities and entertainment companies, news networks, and once-great newspapers. All of this ramifies through society. Every day, in a thousand different ways, Trump's corrosive ethic is validated and replicated. Cruelty is the coin of the realm. It's the way to get ahead. Americans ask themselves and one another the inevitable questions. If the president can get away with it, why can't we? If breaking the rules helps him, why shouldn't it help us? The only way out of this wreckage is to rewrite the cultural script, to make excellence in character admired again. And that starts with recognizing the power of moral example. Finally, brothers and sisters, St. Paul wrote to the church in Philippi, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. My wife Cindy and I have recently discovered a compelling and highly entertaining way to think about such things. We've been watching Foyle's War, a British detective series that began broadcasting in 2002, was canceled for a time, and was revived until it ended in 2015. The series was initially set during World War II in Hastings, a seaside town on the southern coast of England. The drama revolves around Christopher Foyle, a detective chief superintendent. His driver, Samantha Sam Stewart, and Detective Sergeant Paul Milner. The series, notable for its meticulous attention to historic detail, later shifts to London as Foyle and Stewart join MI5 after the war. The plots are multi-layered and intricate. They deal with complex moral dilemmas. Justice in ordinary times versus justice in wartime, for example, and which moral compromises should be made for the greater good of the war effort, with nuance. But what makes this series so remarkable, apart from the brilliant and brilliantly understated acting of Michael Kitchen as Foyle, is that the character is a quiet man who makes a religion of honor, responsibility, and competence, as the television critic Mike Hale wrote in the New York Times. Foyle does so without ever appearing self-righteous or moralistic. Rather, he is a good man trying to do the right thing in a fallen world. It's not so much that we know every ethical line Foyle draws is the exact right one. It's rather that we know he's doing the best he can to pursue justice. He does so even, and sometimes especially, when there's enormous pressure on him to buckle, including from those in power. Foyle's moral compass can't be demagnetized. Foyle treats those over him, over whom he has authority, with respect. He's restrained, not glamorous, wry and scrupulous, a man of quiet strength and uncompromised. It helps, too, that his private life is unstained. He is, to invoke a rather old-fashioned word, a gentleman. You can't imagine Foyle selling his soul for anything, which makes him particularly anomalous today when we see soul-selling all around us. The social scientist James Q. Wilson, in his 1993 book, The Moral Sense, argued that our moral sense is rooted in human nature. He believed that we have a natural capacity for ethical behavior, but that it needs to be nurtured. Mankind has a moral sense, Wilson wrote, but much of the time its reach is short and its effects uncertain. And so when it comes to cultivating moral excellence, we must take our allies where we find them. The best allies are people in your life who personify integrity, who live with honor, and who show us the way. In my own life, I count such people among my greatest blessings. I think of them more than they may know. But fictional characters can help us, too. In his essay on Three Ways of Writing for Children, C.S. Lewis, who also wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, said, "Since it is so likely that children will meet cruel enemies, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage. Otherwise, you are making their destiny not brighter, but darker." Lewis knew the power of stories and the power of heroes to mold the character of children, to inspire them, even to help shape how they see the world. I'd add only that what is true for children is also true for adults. It may not be in quite the same way, but it can still make a difference. We all need to hear from time to time about brave knights and heroic tales, and even perhaps about police detectives in small towns on the south shore of England. Our third article, Live Closer to Your Friends, written by Adrian Mattai. Sometime during the pandemic lockdowns, I began to nurture a fantasy. What if I were neighbors with all of my friends? Every day as I took long walks through North Vancouver that were still nowhere near long enough to land me at a single pal's doorstep, I would reflect on the potential joys of a physically closer network. Wouldn't it be great to have someone who could join me on a stroll at a moment's notice? Or to be able to drop by to cook dinner for a friend and her baby? How good would it be to have more spontaneous hangs instead of ones that had to be planned, scheduled, most likely rescheduled weeks in advance? This doesn't have to be just a dream. Friends who already live in the same city could decide to move within walking distance of one another, the same neighborhood, block, or even apartment building, and campaign for others to do the same. Doing so would likely involve a lot of effort on the front end, but the resulting community could pay emotional dividends for years. Meeting up would be a breeze if you didn't have to travel as far to see one another. More than that, the proximity would make it easier to support one another materially and emotionally. Even just knowing that someone you cherish is near could be reassuring. The more I've thought about it, the more I've become convinced we should all live close to our friends. For the past century, the nuclear family has defined U.S. homes. But long before parents plus 2.5 kids became the norm, Americans lived surrounded by friends and extended family. Clan-style groups of kin and non-kin remain standard in many cultures. Even in the U.S., this mode of living thrives where cultivated. Think of college campuses, which tend to be the kind of walkable communities where you're regularly running into pals on the street or having an impromptu party at someone's place. Queer people have also formed non-biological, quote, chosen families, end quote, and move close to one another. Living across the hall from one's friends is even enshrined in America's most endearing popular TV shows. Yet young adults are conventionally expected to focus on their career, getting married, and starting a family. Putting this energy into coordinating a move with all of your buddies may seem quirky, but doing so actually could be good for you. Having supportive friends is associated with greater day-to-day happiness and longer lifespans, sometimes even more so than having strong familiar or spousal relationships. It's also linked to lower levels of depression and mental decline as we age. And friends are particularly important at a time when 36% of Americans report feeling serious loneliness. Although technology is making it easier to maintain long-distance bonds, nothing can replace seeing friends in person. Researchers have found that happiness spreads like an emotional contagion, especially among those who live close together. When one person becomes happier, their next-door neighbor's chances of also growing happier rise by 34%. Friends living within a mile of each other are 25% more likely to feel happy, and their friends have a 10% chance of feeling happier, too. Live around people who make you happy, and you might create a feedback loop that perks up everyone around you. Having a pal around is also just practical. For people with kids, a friend in the neighborhood might be able to help with childcare in a pinch, saving you the cost of a last-minute sitter. Those without children might welcome the chance to bond with friends' kids. And for those who live alone, proximity to friends can make saving on some things easier. You might share household items you don't need every day, or split bulk groceries, for example. But no matter what your particular setup, being around more people you trust makes getting through hard moments easier. Friends in the neighborhood can drive you to the hospital in an emergency, saving you an expensive ambulance ride, or they can simply come over when you're feeling down or bring you a hot meal when you're sick. Logistically, becoming closer with your neighbors might sound simpler than contriving proximity to friends, but it's reasonable to want the people you already love to be nearby. I don't think there's any shame in saying, I really miss my friends that I've known for 10 years and want to really hold on and maintain those connections, Grace Veith, a PhD candidate researching adult friendship at the University of Minnesota's Social Interaction Lab, told me. Plus, making new friends in adulthood is notoriously tricky. 22% of Americans say they haven't made a new friend in the past 5 years. Many people are prepared to move for a new job, to be with a romantic partner, or even just an adventure. Moving to be closer to buddies should be no different. Friends are not incidental to a good life. They're essential to one. So why not shorten the distance between you and them? We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.